The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. All the way from Melbourne in Australia, I want to welcome our very special guest today, Juliet Stead, SVP for JPAC for Magnite. Welcome, Juliet.
Thanks very much, Rachel.
And Lindsay Rountree over in Walthamstow. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm really good. I'm pleased you got my name right this week. It's progress.
So further to Felicity's benefit, obviously I had to retake pronouncing Juliet's name. That's par for the course. But I even got Lindsay's name wrong last week. Brilliant. And, I mean, I suppose my only defence is it's quite early here for us in London because, Juliet, you're based in Melbourne and we were just having a conversation about how things are maybe getting slightly more optimistic for you over there.
Yes, absolutely. So the numbers are going down, which means that hopefully we should be out of lockdown at some point soon. We haven't been going very far. We've had to stay within 5 kilometres of our houses for about 3 months now. So I'm quite ready for things to change.
Not surprised. And, you know, wow. I mean, yeah, for those of us based in the UK, we're just like, whoa, an actual lockdown that goes on for a long period of time. Can't imagine it. Anyway, let's not digress into COVID territory. Let's talk about news of the week in ad tech and martech. First news story I wanted to chat through with you two is an interesting report that was published by PwC earlier in the week. Comparing revenue from global streaming platforms with worldwide box office revenue. So for the first time this year, global streaming platform revenue has surpassed that of box office revenue. Now, to some respects, that might not be surprising given that it's the year of the pandemic. So, of course, cinemas have been closed for a very long period of time. We know lots of box office releases have been withdrawn or delayed. There's certainly got to be, some speculation that production for big films has slowed down. And of course, we've all been at home. So no doubt we've been consuming more streaming-related revenue, and that's probably seen an uptick in subscription revenue services. But what's really interesting about this is that PwC detailed some figures here, which is that actually the revenue obtained from streaming and box office in 2019 was actually quite close, much closer than I expected it to be. So the 2019 figures were $37 billion going to global streaming platforms and $42.5 billion being turned over at the box office. Now, for 2020, the figures are drastically different. So it's looking like the streaming revenue market's growing to $50 billion this year, and it's and for the box office market, it's reduced right down to $15 billion. So it's a suggestion in part that, more revenue is able to be obtained from entertainment platforms. As I said, there's clearly a link with what's happened during the pandemic to consumer behaviour and consumption behaviour. But I'm wondering if this is a trend, although inspired by the pandemic, that we might see sustained beyond 2020. And of course, you know, there's a huge impact on advertising in both box office environment and a streaming environment, because if we're talking about revenue derived from streaming, we're going to be in part talking about subscription-funded revenue, but there will also be an uptick, presumably, in ad-funded revenue as well. So, Juliet, what's your point of view on this story?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously we've been seeing audiences move to streaming environments for quite some time now, and we've seen so many content providers investing in content and technology and apps and so on to ensure that they've got the right environments to accommodate that migration over to streaming environments. But we've just seen such a concentrated period, haven't we, over this COVID situation, let's call it, where nobody has been leaving their houses for a significant period of time, as you say, some more than others, me, for example. But over that period, we've definitely seen a significant increase in streaming consumption. I saw some stats the other day, in fact, around Asia. A lot of markets in Asia are mobile first, and we actually saw that mobile video streaming on a weekly basis has increased by 60% over the crisis period. So globally, we are absolutely seeing that streaming has been increasing significantly over the past few years, but we've seen a massive acceleration over the crisis. And obviously, cinema has really suffered as a result of that. People haven't necessarily been able to leave the house to go to the cinema, or they haven't necessarily felt as comfortable to do so as they would have done previously. And so content providers and content distributors have had to find different ways of getting their content out in front of people. And certainly we're going to see that those revenues will replicate the way in which audiences have been behaving and the way in which audiences have been consuming their content. And in fact, I saw a story a couple of days ago around Disney, and Disney have a new Pixar movie coming out really soon called Soul. And they've decided that they're actually going to release that movie on Disney Plus instead of via a theatrical release. And so we're seeing some of those sudden changes and essentially saying, look, we have been investing in our infrastructure for quite some time. We have seen our audiences increasing in those streaming environments, and we're going to embrace those streaming environments to benefit our business when we're seeing this crisis affect our usual method of distribution, as in cinema, to ensure that we're still able to get our content in front of the right audiences. And so we're seeing some significant changes in the way in which that those audiences are reached by those content providers. And then in other situations, though, we're just seeing that releases, as you just said, Rachel, we're seeing that those releases are simply being delayed. There are some big releases, aren't there? Is it the new Bond movie? Yeah. That's being delayed now until the first half of next year at the earliest.
Yeah.
So we're seeing lots of different reactions essentially to our current situation, which hopefully will in itself change soon.
Yes, fingers bloody crossed for that.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, a content producer has got a direct channel that they could utilise, like Disney. So this is what's fascinating about Disney setting up Disney Plus. And I can remember in the early days of them even sort of making the announcement that they were intending to do that, we had lots of conversations about how they would battle it out with Netflix. We talked a lot about the strength of Disney's existing catalogue, but it's really interesting to sort of reflect for a moment on the fact that they can also create and produce movies and not worry about the box office at all and just take it straight to their own streaming channels. Of course, Netflix do the same thing too. But I wonder, you know, whether there's the same ability for other content producers who are producing big scale films to be able to utilize suitable channels in the same way. There's just so much to think about here. I wonder the other thing is as well is, is this behavior change going to herald the death of cinema? You know, the death of cinema has been talked about since I was a child, basically, as soon as video came along. There was lots of prediction about how people will ultimately prefer to watch content in the comfort of their own homes, but that sort of didn't really happen off the back of video. So I just wonder if we're actually going to get pushed to that point. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I feel that it would be a massive shame if this did spell the end of cinema. In the UK, obviously, Cineworld have had to close their cinemas, not permanently, but at least indefinitely. And it was the delay of Bond until April or later next year that was the final straw for them. They can't afford to stay open, and Bond has inadvertently put 5,500 jobs at risk in the UK, which is quite incredible, really. But I was also surprised, Rachel, you mentioned that the numbers of streaming versus cinema are actually kind of fairly on par. That surprised me too. And I looked it up, and in the UK, there were 176 million admissions to cinemas in 2019, which is far greater than I thought. I thought it'd be a far lower number than that. That's probably about 2 admissions this year, but it's a far bigger medium than I thought it was. And I've always thought that there's death of cinema as an advertising medium. It hasn't really got any legs. It's got nowhere to go. But you speak to people that work in cinema and they completely disagree and say, no, it's actually still very buoyant. And it's still a very, very captive audience. And there are still many brands that really, there's no medium quite like cinema for them where they would want to invest their budget into. So it's still big. And there are these tentpole films like Bond that are supposed to be helping to keep the industry alive. But it is those delays, and also it's the brands like Disney that are able to go, we're not going to release it into cinemas, we're going to put it on our own platform. I think there was was it Mulan or something that released recently? I don't know if it was supposed to go into cinemas, but they did put it on the Disney Plus platform instead, making you pay 20 quid for it, which is actually more than you probably pay to go to the cinema, which I thought was amazing, really, that they're actually charging that amount of money, probably globally, when to go to cinema probably costs about £15, maybe in London. I don't actually haven't been to cinema for a long time, but between £10 and £15. It surprised me how much they were charging for this film. But I guess they can charge that for a household versus each individual person going to cinema. So for them, it kind of makes up revenue. But it's a shame that there are platforms out there like that can do that and release on streaming instead, because it again just spells another death knell for cinema. Because will they continue to do that? Will they see the value of cinema coming out of this when cinemas start to reopen again? I read something in India. They're opening their cinemas again this week. And the kind of the content distribution network and UFO, which is the in-cinema ad platform, a bit like DCM in the UK, I think, are supporting film producers, distributors and cinemas by introducing reductions and rate card changes to how they to the fees, to basically, because there are a lot of big Bollywood films coming out and they want to encourage them to distribute them in cinemas and not delay them or put them on streaming services. So they're trying to encourage them, reduce the rates of entry, the barriers to entry, basically, to encourage them to put them in cinemas, to get people out and about again and keep the cinema industry alive. I guess that works well for a market like India, where it's quite an insulated kind of film network, obviously with Bollywood being so big. It doesn't work so well for global releases, but it was really interesting to read that they're doing what they can to try to help keep the cinema industry afloat, something that I'm not seeing happen in other industries as such.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I was just about to, sort of ask a question about thoughts on India because of the Bollywood industry being so huge. I mean, that must say something also about their appreciation of the cultural sort of relationship that the country's got with that form of entertainment, and how important it is that they get that out to a mass audience. And it could be slightly connected to what you mentioned earlier, Juliet, about a lot of countries within Asia are being mobile first. There's got to be an enormous amount of consumers in India that may well be, sort of connected via a mobile device, but wouldn't be able to access content via a streaming service, certainly not one that's subscription-based, because they wouldn't be able to afford to. Now, I don't know what the affordability of cinema trips is like either, but it's interesting that the industry is, that the producers and makers of film are trying very hard to continue to support the cinema industry. What are your thoughts on, the death of cinema, Juliet?
I mean, I would very much hope that this isn't the death of cinema. I think it's really important for us to all remember that this COVID period is not the new normal. I can't stand the term new normal. This is a blip. This is something that is going horribly wrong for us as for us globally. But we will come out of it at some point. And when we do come out of it, I think people are going to be looking for things that they can do that remind them of their world previous to this. So I would hope that this isn't the death of cinema. I'd hope that this is a world that can actually sustain all sorts of types of entertainment in the home and outside of the home. I think when it comes to advertiser spend, that obviously is going to back up a lot of this stuff, advertiser spend generally follows audiences. If audiences choose to go back to cinemas, advertiser spend will go to that cinema advertising as well. In the same way that we have seen audiences migrate to streaming services, and we have seen huge revenue increases across those streaming services. And so essentially, I'm hoping anyway that we will revert to a version of a world that can sustain advertising revenue across all of those different environments that is largely relative to where audiences have gone.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. I'd be very sad if cinema disappeared. And I feel like it's one of those things, certainly one of those things on the list of things that I've got of stuff I want to do when I'm able to. I mean, you can still go to the cinema in London at the moment, but there aren't that many cinemas open. The releases are quite limited. But it's the idea that, it's a pleasurable thing to do. And I sort of feel like when everyone feels that's safe to do it again, there'll be people flocking to it. And I feel the same way about travel. 100%. It's just a matter of time. And that's an interesting way to look at it as well, Juliet, because you're right. we will look back on this in history as a blip, rather than something that feels like it's going on forever. Yeah. It just feels like it's going on forever at the moment because we're in the middle of it.
Exactly. And I think we also sometimes need to take ourselves outside of our media and advertising world and look at other things. You know, through this period, we've also seen huge changes to retail. We've seen a lot of stores have to close temporarily, some permanently, and we've seen a lot of those retailers have to rely on e-commerce in order to survive through this period. And some of them already had e-commerce functionality, some of them didn't, and had to react very quickly to put something in place. Does it mean that once this is all over, they will no longer have stores? I would say that that probably will be the case in some situations, but I think a lot of people will still want to actually go into a shop to look at clothes and try clothes on and buy them without it all reverting to online shopping only. Mm. And so I think we need to look at this period essentially being an accelerator for change, but not necessarily changing the world beyond recognition.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Okay, I'm going to move us on to the second story because it's somewhat related. Research that was published in Business Insider earlier this week revealing that ad-funded video on demand, so AVOD, ad-funded streamed content, is gathering popularity year on year. Viewer figures are up for AVOD from 2019 in the US to 17% from 13% in 2019. And this is amongst the US adult audience. So it's suggesting a higher tolerance for ad-funded content than before. SVOD, so subscription services, have still got the lion's share of viewers, but we're starting to see ad-funded content becoming more and more consumed from a popular point of view. Now, there's an argument to suggest that that could be because the quality of ad-funded content is increasing and arguably the same standard as the quality of subscription-funded content. So perhaps there's more availability of it. But there's also some interesting stats backing this up that suggest that ad-funded content's really popular amongst an older audience, so the sort of 45 to 60 age range, which could suggest that this is an audience that's quite tolerant of ads content anyway, you know, advertising content anyway. They won't necessarily have, they'll have all experienced some form of subscription funded content because it's been around for a while now, but they won't have grown up with that sort of stuff. Cable TV in the US would still come with, you know, a high degree of advertising as well, just not as much advertising as non-cable TV. So, for what it's worth, it is very US based, but I thought it's an interesting follow on from the conversation that we've just had, which is to what extent are people tolerance of advertising in that kind of at home or on a mobile device, personally consumed content environment. And I think this is something personally that differs from market to market because tolerance for ads is completely different in the US to what it is in Australia, to what it is over in Europe. So I'm just really interested to hear your perspectives on this. This feels like also, it's definitely a boost to viewership for ad-funded content in the US year over year, but it doesn't feel like it's a dramatically huge increase. So again, maybe this is something that's a bit more of a gradual slow burn and not something that's necessarily been accelerated specifically because of pandemic circumstances. Lindsay, I'm going to go to you first and then hear what Juliet thinks.
I think interesting. I think, as you said, Rachel, the fact that the older generation is more tolerant to ad-funded than subscription-funded video on demand is endemic of the fact that they are used to advertising and have grown up with advertising, whereas the younger generation have not. But I think also the higher tolerance in general is probably because more older generations are now streaming where they weren't before in the first place. They're probably still investing in cable TV. And I think the US is always an interesting market. And what annoys me about this, and Juliet, your thoughts on this from where you sit in the world will be very different, of course, because my problem with when we talk about CTV in general, anything VOD related, is that it's always very US centric. And the US is just such a different market from every other market around it. Like, Every market in Europe is different. Every market in APAC is different. So in the US, they talk a lot about cord cutting and cord shaving and the cord nevers. So all these cord cutters that were paying ridiculous amounts of money for cable TV are now going, actually, I can watch this for free or for very little per month and still see ads, and probably maybe even fewer ads than I was seeing on cable TV, because the number of ads that you consume on cable TV in the US, and actually, Rachel, you said it's quite similar in Australia as well, but in the UK, we don't have all that many ads versus the US. So it's always a shock to go there and witness how many ads they do actually have in an ad pod.
100%.
And how many ad pods there are in one TV show. But I do think that there will be more cord shaving or cord cutting from the older generations in the US as they start to realise there's so much more opportunity out there than what cable TV can offer. I think in the UK, it's slightly different because at the moment, you can't find the same show on tons of different platforms. In the US, you can. In the UK, if you want to watch Game of Thrones, you need Sky or Now TV, which is the same company. If you want to watch Stranger Things, you need Netflix. If you want to watch this, like everything is on different platforms. You do find yourself kind of buying everything. And I think that we haven't really got much. There's not so much AVOD in the UK as there is SVOD, but I think there's probably definitely more opportunity, particularly among the older generations that might not be sure what where their future lies with set-top boxes or with Freeview TV that we have over here. They might be more receptive to trialing more AVOD type models in the UK than we currently have access to.
Yeah. Juliette, what's your point of view? I wonder as well if there's, we've talked about this many times before in previous podcasts, but a while back, wonder if there's some subscription fatigue, baked into this as well, that actually if it's on offer, why wouldn't you go for high quality content that's ad funded if you've already got half a dozen subscriptions? Yeah.
No, absolutely. And there was the Trade Desk did some research, and this was in the US actually, but from that research, the majority of respondents said that they'd only tolerate two or three subscriptions. So they'd only be prepared to spend about $20 a month on streaming services in total. And that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because once you've hit those two or three, you know, maybe Netflix, maybe Disney Plus, then what are you going to do? Are you just going to rely on those two streaming services for all of your content, or are you going to look to ad-funded environments as well? In Australia, I would say that Australia is probably a little bit more similar to the UK in terms of streaming services. So we have Netflix and we have Disney Plus and we have Stan, for example, and a few others in terms of SVOD options. And then everything else really is the free-to-air broadcasters who have invested really heavily in their BVOD services, so broadcast video on demand services. And there was some really nice, so the research that you just referenced, Rachel, that was on Pair, wasn't it? And I saw some research from the same guys earlier this year at the Future of Television conference. And they showed that here in Australia, the most popular streaming service is Netflix. And then after that, it's actually the free-to-air broadcasters combined who provide the next level of audience. I think Netflix was like 51%. And the BVOD providers came at 34% combined in terms of percentage of streaming households who could be accessed through those services. And so you can actually see that in this market, where we've got SVOD, who are providing good, strong content, and Lindsay, it's exactly the same situation here as it is in the UK. You don't have the same content on multiple platforms. It's generally one or the other. But here you've generally got... You know, you've got all of these free-to-air broadcasters who've invested really heavily in content, so live streaming, catch-up content, as well as catalogue content as well. And they've invested really heavily in their apps, so in technology and having really good infrastructure so that audiences can access that content on whichever connected device they choose to access it on, you know, whether it's a smart TV or a phone or through an OTT device. And essentially, that means that, you know, viewing behaviour, I would say, here in Australia is largely led by that. I'm going to have maybe one or two subscriptions, but I'm also going to watch content wherever that content lives. I'm not necessarily going to pay four or five subscriptions to chase that content, but I will pay a couple, and then I'll just go to the free-to-air broadcasters to ensure that I'm accessing everything that I want to access. I mean, speaking personally, I'm just going to watch the stuff that I want to watch. And so earlier this year, I was watching pretty much every bit of, this sounds really silly, but every bit of Nordic noir that I could get my hands on. I got really fixated on that sort of content. And I was watching all of that on SBS, which is a free-to-air broadcast catch-up service. Yeah. It's almost our version of Channel 4. Okay, yeah. So it's public service broadcaster, really awesome drama. So I was watching all of that content, and then the pandemic got worse and worse and worse. And recently, I've not been able to watch anything more than billions on Stan, which is a subscription video on demand service, just because it's silly and it's full of escapism and nobody gets murdered. And to me, that has purely been about my mood and about content. It's not been influenced at all by the fact that SBS is ad-funded, whereas Stan is subscription. That's got nothing to do with it. Stan just happens to be one of the SVOD services that I subscribe to. And SBS happens to be one of the many free-to-air broadcast video-on-demand environments that has invested well in really good content. Yeah. And yeah, I just happen to feel a bit stronger at the beginning of the pandemic than I have done recently. So,
so that was that. Yeah, but it's interesting though, because I mean, okay, so the first thing I'd say about that is, the first thing I'm going to say about that is you need to watch, if you haven't already, Lilyhammer, which was available on Netflix. So that is a perfect bridge between Scandi noir and silly comedy. So that's my tip for you. Second thing I was going to say there is I completely recognise that experience. I feel like it's the sort of experience that I've had as well. And Lindsay, I bet it's familiar to you to some extent. But then I would say we've all got the luxury of having the choice, right? Because we can go, oh, I want that content there. Oh, okay, well, I'll pay for the subscription there. What about the potential of the audience that doesn't have the purse strings to stretch to all of those services? They will make a selection. And what's interesting to me is what are they going to make that selection based on? You imagine it's based on content, but you know, I don't know. And then how do sort of content providers tackle that? And that's what I wonder if we're seeing in the US, because they've just got a much more diverse marketplace anyway for content production and you know, options via which to consume it. Are we seeing ad-funded, you know, AVOD coming forward with more compelling offerings because they're starting to try to tap into that market of people that definitely want the content but don't have the purse strings to pay for it?
I don't know. I mean, I would say that the free-to-air broadcasters who are bringing their AVOD services to market have huge levels of content. The research that I've seen, though, has shown that they are actually appealing to younger and wealthier audiences through their BVOD services than they are appealing to through their linear broadcast services. And so I would definitely agree that free is accessible to everybody, of course. But I wouldn't necessarily say that that is the key thing to focus on around audiences. And it's certainly not what I've seen represented in the research that I've been exposed to. And again, thinking about it, that bit of research that I saw showing the more valuable demographic profile of BVOD versus linear broadcast, that was also from Ampere, and that was at Future of TV as well. I mean, that was last year's conference. They're always the best presentations. They do really great presentations and insights into TV and BVOD audiences, so I'm always pricking my ears up to those guys.
And is it always US focused, Juliet?
No.
Okay, so they
actually
do
really good global insights. Yeah. Really good global insights. Absolutely. Yeah. But I think when we're coming back to the, you know, the AVOD versus SVOD thing, in my mind, it's always about a value exchange. It's always around whether the subscription is worthwhile. Am I getting the right content and the right experience for that subscription? And am I prepared to subscribe to more than one or two or three services? And then likewise, when it comes to advertising, the value exchange is around, is that advertising experience hindering my viewing experience, or is it neutral, or is it adding to it? You know, is it sort of neutral or positive? Because if it's negative, then I'm probably not going to keep going there. And from my perspective here in Australia, we work with all of the free-to-air broadcasters across all of their BVOD and New Zealand as well, actually. And then we work with several across Asia. And we work really hard to make sure that all of our publishers have the right tools to make sure that it is a good ad experience, and that we are able to work with data to create a more relevant ad experience, and that we are able to allow publishers to adhere to all of their business rules so that there are no back-to-back ads or repetitive ads or excessive frequencies and all of that sort of stuff. So from an ad tech perspective, it's really important for all publishers who are going into that OTT space to make sure that they're creating an environment that's good for users, good for brands, good for everybody, essentially, because if they don't, they're going to jeopardize their entire future roadmap and growth projections, essentially.
Yeah, 100%. Lindsay, some thoughts on AVOD v SVOD?
Yeah, I think what Julia just said about how it's advancing and the importance of the opportunity that exists within AVOD, I think it's interesting that there is so much scale and opportunity available with ad-funded video advertising. And I think that's the exciting bit is the reach and frequency, the technology behind it, looking at what goes into it, trying not to, where it comes to kind of bringing technology and programmatic and automation into how that operates, trying to remove some of the challenges and the mistakes we've made in programmatic display and make sure that we've got the beauty of hindsight not to bring them into the TV world. I think that will be the very, very interesting thing. I mean, at the moment, it doesn't feel like we're there yet. There's still a lot to do. And obviously, market by market, the scale and opportunity is completely different. Some are really nascent, some like the US are really advanced. In the UK, for example, if I'm watching BVOD, a lot of the ads are repeated. And there's one in particular, an Asda, which is a British supermarket chain, soon not to be owned by Walmart, actually, but they got a new ad out that drives me up the fucking wall, excuse my French. And if I say it one more time, but every show I watch, it has it on every ad break. I'm like, we've still got a long way to go. And that's not just technology, that's the amount of imagery available, that's the amount of, there's a lot of reasons why that ad keeps getting shown, but there's still a lot we can do. But I do feel it's exciting, and I feel the technology that's behind it, technology that's backing this, and the just the want from the industry to be able to push this forward, it makes it very exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we work really hard to ensure doesn't happen. So we work really closely with our broadcasters to say, actually not just with the broadcasters, but also with the buyers, make sure that the buyers are using the right technology themselves on their side. So with the DSPs, to ensure that they're frequency capping to create a good experience and to not hammer home their message to the point where they're annoying people and putting people off. And then we work very hard with the broadcasters as well to ensure that ad pods are used to the best of their possible ability, and that we have all the tools in place, even with the most complex supply, to ensure that we're not having any repetition or excessive repetition beyond the plan.
Yeah, good. Because, I mean, I only just recently watched some BVOD the other day. I hadn't watched any for a long time, and I was intrigued to see what the advertising experience was going to be like. I had a bit of a similar experience to Lindsay, maybe not quite as irritating. But what there were some positives, though, which is that I felt like I was getting shown much more relevant ads than I've been shown for a long time. And there was at least one in there that I was like, oh, that's actually interesting to me. So, I mean, and, you know, maybe I'm paying more attention just because I work in the industry, but I remembered, you know, walking away from that experience thinking, bit of annoying repetition, but getting much better, getting much better. So if we can just keep driving that experience in the right direction, it'll make a massive difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to move us on to the last news story for discussion today, which is an opportunity to talk about something that we've been, you know, sort of talking about behind the scenes and informally throughout the entire period of the pandemic, and it's just getting a more and more interesting topic as the months tick by. Microsoft made an announcement earlier in the week that they will be enabling staff to have the option of permanently working from home. Follows suit with some other big global companies, tech companies in particular, the likes of Facebook and Twitter, who made similar announcements in the summer, in the Northern Hemisphere summer earlier this year. And it begs the question whether others will follow suit. What's interesting about this is the specific details, which are kind of quite, you know, in line with what a few other companies have said too, is that, you know, this will be based, this option will be based around staff who obviously can work remotely in a permanent capacity, because there'll still be some roles that require in-person contact, but also that they will be moving to a scenario where all staff can work from home in a part-time capacity without explicit approval from their manager. Now, presumably, they've still got to have conversations about how they're handling things and where they're going to be, but the idea is they don't need to seek permission for that kind of flexibility. They also say in their statement that this is very much for them about underscoring a working and organisational culture. It's not just about the practicalities of how work gets done, but it's about recognising that, you know, the positives of this period of time and everybody home working has driven home the need to understand flexibility goes across a number of different lifestyles, and actually that needs to be reflected in a working environment. So this is super interesting because, I mean, I'm sure you guys are the same. I've been talking about it with everybody since the start of the pandemic, no matter what industry they work in, no matter what size organization and company. There's many related impacts to this. It's not just about what happens within an organization and what happens within a culture and then how that impacts individuals that work in teams, but it's also about what it does to our understanding of how our workplaces are created. So what does it do to city centers that are structured around office environments? What does it do actually to those sort of office, I want to call them retail parks. They're not retail parks because that includes retail. I mean, business parks, designated business parks that aren't based in city centres and are exclusively built for the purpose of attracting office workers. What's that going to do to those sorts of environments? And what, again, a bit of a common thread through all of our stories, what in all of this is going to be not just a near-term trend that's been inspired by the pandemic, but something that's going to sustain? I've got my own views, of course, based on what we're doing here at Exchange. I'd be fascinating to start with you, Juliet, working for a global company that's no doubt got a lot of office space all over the world.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I think we've been seeing this for a while now, haven't we? Over recent years, we've heard so many businesses talk about the way in which they could potentially change their working practice, that it's not necessarily about 9 till 6, Monday to Friday, being in an office, clocking in, clocking out, job done. You know, there have been so many organisations that have been quite forward thinking around the way that they could look to work, and they have just been forced to do it a lot more quickly and a lot more extremely over this year. And that's not necessarily indicative of what flexible working or different ways of working could look like in the long term, but it has certainly forced businesses to reconsider or to think creatively and to essentially work out very quickly how they could sustain their business with everybody working from home. And what I'm really hoping for is, you know, for myself and my team, for businesses generally, is that we're able to take some real positives out of it and think creatively and look at how we can actually adapt in the long term to create something that is more suited to modern ways of working, where we actually have, you know, technology and internet connections and laptops and that sort of stuff. And obviously that's not, you know, obviously I've got to recognize that that isn't for everybody and not every business would be able to sustain that sort of stuff, but there isn't ever going to be a one rule fits all, and we've got to work out what is suited to individual businesses and to individual teams, and how can we actually create something that is more flexible wherever possible so that we can create better opportunities for people within the workplace. Whether that's, you know, I think there are lots of benefits to equality. I think from a, you know, I am a mum who has a job, and for me to have some flexibility that allows me to be at home to have breakfast with my little girl and to be home for dinner and to get her in the bath and get her to bed whilst also doing a really big job during the day and potentially when she's gone to bed as well. For me to have that flexibility, that's really important. And I have always tried to ensure that my team has had access to that level of flexibility and trust as well. And I personally think that wherever that is feasible, it's a really good thing. You know, over this period, from a Magnite perspective, we've all been working from home now since March this year, I believe. And there have definitely been some really difficult parts of that. You know, we have missed out on some of the stuff that we normally love, being around each other. We all actually like each other. We like spending time together. And not being able to do that at all has been really tough. But on the other hand, we haven't had to commute. And so, you know, getting what you guys are in London, you know, getting 2 hours of your day back potentially and being able to spend that doing other things can be a really beneficial thing to do, and it can be really good for people and good for mental health and a better way of spending your time potentially. But all of that doesn't necessarily mean that we should all be working from home all of the time forevermore. It means that we can think creatively and apply some of these learnings to more sustainable practice.
Yeah, 100%. Lindsay?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that there shouldn't be it's all or nothing. There needs to be a compromising hybrid approach if these companies want to be able to introduce flexibility. I mean, I personally, having worked from home, I found great benefit from it. Juliet, as you said, obviously living in London, the 2 hours, 1 hour each way commute, you don't realise how frustrating it is and how much it actually fills you with anxiety every day until you stop doing it and you go, oh God, I feel so much better starting my day. But having started to kind of filter back into the office, which I'll probably be banned from doing now because our London mayor wants to put us in lockdown again, has reminded me how important it is to be able to be in front of people. And the problem with constant Zoom calls is that you are giving all your energy to the person you're speaking to and you're getting none back because it's through a screen. And when you're actually speaking to a person face to face, it reminds you how much energy there is in a face-to-face conversation. So we can't remove that completely. There are some companies that do really well with everyone working from home. WordPress is a great example. I think WordPress give every new starter a certain amount of money to kit out their home office, and they have no physical offices. Everybody works from home, and for them as a business, it's worked fine. And if you're that kind of person that wants to be able to work that way, then fantastic. There are companies out there, but for many big global companies where that has been the way that they've grown up with office space, I think it would be a shame to get rid of it entirely. But I think you do need, while you need flexibility, you also need to be able to have rules in place. So if somebody is going to be working from home, it will need to be the same days each week rather than just randomly one morning going, oh, by the way, I'm working from home today. But you can't then have like the home working from home clique and the people that are in the office clique, because then you'll start feeling separation between teams, and collaboration and culture and energy gets lost. But I think that also at the moment, particularly a lot of big global companies, finance teams are involved, and they're thinking, there are huge potential savings to be had here from not operating our offices. Not even just rent on offices, but even things like printer paper. There's so much money to be saved, like stocking the drinks fridge. These are things that finance teams are so excited about because saving money. So we need to not let finance control everything, because if they had it their way, they'd shut all offices down tomorrow probably. But also not let the people that think that mental health means that the answer to positive mental health means everybody should work from home forever. Because I know people that realise that the only reason they enjoy their jobs is because of the people they work with. And having not been able to see them for the past 6 months has caused them to really rethink where they're working. And that is a huge issue. It just shows the importance of culture in a job.
That's the thing. I just think it's actually quite an individual thing, company by company, across teams, depending on the type of work that you're doing, catering for individuals. To me, flexibility is not about, sort of accommodating absolutely everybody's best case scenario. It's about all of us trying to arrive at a position that we think we can live with and that works for the benefit of others and the benefit of the company. Now, that's easy for me to say because I own and run a small business where we have, there's eight of us that work in it in total. So it's quite easy for us to negotiate around that. And I think we've done a pretty good job of it. We're quite confident in our mindset of how we're going to carry on with things going forward, regardless of what situations we find ourselves in, a plan for full lockdown, a plan for semi-lockdown, a plan for when we can return to more in-person, face-to-face interactions. But, when you're running a big organisation and a big company and dealing with lots of global office sites, that's got to be a headache. That's got to be an entirely different scenario. Maybe, Juliet, what you've described that you guys have done at Magnite sounds like it's worked pretty well so far, but someone within Magnite must be having a little bit of a head wreck at the moment going, what should we do? What should we do? Should we downsize some of our office space? Do we need to implement a policy that's company-wide? Do we do things on a country-by-country basis? Because there's one other thing I'd mention as well, is that I'd like to see more of a recognition of the fact that, flexible working needs to also entail the fact that many people work for global companies across all different time zones and therefore find themselves working from home at all hours of the day, right? So, Juliet, you'll know exactly where I'm going with this. When you live on the East Coast of Australia and you need to speak to anyone in Europe and most people in the US, you're doing that when everybody else is having downtime. Everyone else around you is having downtime. You're spending your evenings talking to people. You're maybe getting up super early in the morning to talk to people. And that's commonplace, right?
Oh, absolutely. That definitely is my normal world. But that isn't necessarily impacted by whether I'm working from home or not. That is just part of the job. When I'm supposed to be finishing for the day, that's when the UK offices are just coming online. And then the East Coast come online a bit later, and then the West Coast comes online a bit later than that. So as soon as I wake up, I've got dozens and dozens of emails from all sorts of different time zones that I need to reply to as quickly as possible before I've even hit the shower, so that I can get back to those people as quickly as I can and we can continue that conversation before they finish for the day, essentially. Mm. And so that's more a symptom of global working as opposed to anything to do with flexibility or working from home. I just happen to have my laptop here all of the time rather than doing it from my phone in the evenings normally. And in fact, you know, in some ways it makes it a little bit easier because everything is set up for me and I don't have to compromise. I can access all of my documents and files yep. all the time. But yep. I think my situation is slightly unusual. I do have to accommodate, you know, 24 hours of time zones.
Yeah, I think that is a particular challenge when you're working in Australia. But I mean, I've got plenty of friends that work in different industries, some of which require more. So say, for example, I've got a friend who's a computer animator and he animates for, you know, film and television, and they have a lot of clients that are based in the US and some, and their HQ is over here in London. And so it's not uncommon for him. He doesn't live very far from the office. He lives in Sydney. It's not uncommon for him to get in the car at 9 and 10 o'clock at night and go, I'm going into the office because I need to do something that requires a much heavier setup than what I've got here at home, and I need to jump on a call and speak with the people in London or the US at the same time. And anyway, you're right, that's part of the job, right? But I suppose what I mean is I think it would be good for organisations to really bake that into the way that they're thinking about the ways in which people work. You know, it's not just a recognition of the fact that people can get good quality work done in all sorts of locations, not just in the office, but also that there are some people that are probably working to accommodate lots of different time zones, and that might change how they're working day structured. Another example is everyone that I work with in Singapore. You know, the Singapore working day quite often starts a fair bit later. So, you know, people are often not in the office before 9:30 in the morning, maybe 10, because they work a day and then things really start kicking off at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and then they're getting hold of US clients at 9 o'clock. So not uncommon to go for dinner with somebody in Singapore and for it to get to 9 and them to go, I'm just popping outside to jump on a work call. And, you know, I think we get a lot less of that in the UK. Perhaps it's time zone based. I don't know, you know. Anyway, there's many things to be considered. Right, I'm going to move us on because we're running out of time. Juliet, I want to hear a little bit about what Magnite have been focusing on over the last couple of months. You've talked a little bit about the world of TV and all of your capabilities in that area. Tell me what have been the priorities for you guys over the last couple of months.
So one of our big priorities has been becoming Magnite. So as well as the pandemic, we've also been through our merger. I come from the Telaria side of the business. So Telaria and Rubicon Project merged around March this year. So perfect timing, actually, with the pandemic, which essentially meant that all of the normal things that you would do in the early stages of a merger weren't able to happen in terms of actually meeting people in person and that sort of thing. So I've been managing the merger across the Asia Pacific and Japan region. I've got a team of about 43 people here, around half and half. So about half came from Telaria, around half from the Rubicon Project. Historically, Telaria has been very focused on CTV. Historically, Rubicon Project, omnichannel, so display and video and audio and digital out of home. And essentially, we merged those two businesses to ensure that we had all of the smarts of omnichannel as well as the expertise around connected TV and OTT. And so we have been making all of that work, and thank goodness we've done a very, very good job of it under very trying circumstances. Yeah, absolutely. So that has been my big focus for the year. But it's been going incredibly well. We have been incredibly fortunate in the sense that the people who came from both sides of the business have gelled very well in spite of the difficulties around not being able to get together in person. We've been spending a huge amount of time on video calls for reciprocal training, for planning, for ensuring that our publishers never see anything being compromised and that they only ever benefit from the merging of the two organisations. So, it's been a very, very busy year. It's been exciting. It's been exhausting. But it has also been really fruitful. We've been really successful. It's gone very well.
Imagine what it's going to be like when you can all actually see each other in person. Won't that be incredible?
Goodness, I can't. It'll be absolutely incredible. And being able to travel again, you know. So I've now got a team in Tokyo. I've got a lot of new people in Singapore. I've got a couple of people in New Zealand, and I've got the team up in Sydney as well. So being able to get on flights and actually see those people in person, meet them, congratulate them, the whole shebang, I'm really looking forward to it.
And it sounds like it's you know, it's a good match of complementary capabilities, you know, bringing the Telaria, you know, CTV capabilities together with everything that Rubicon was offering. Is that how the merger is feeling at the moment? Does it feel like, you know, for staff as well involved in the detail of delivering some of that stuff? Does that feel like a good fit?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been really strong actually. So in terms of who we could have merged with, it couldn't have been better because there was no overlap, there was no conflict. We both were coming at this from an SSP perspective, so very focused on publisher success, very focused on programmatic. And in terms of the complementary skill sets around display and digital at home, audio and OTT, it's been really beneficial because a lot of the publishers who we work with have both OTT and display, or they have audio and display. And so essentially we've been able to centralize all of their conversations around what they're doing in that programmatic space. So we've been able to create a lot of efficiencies for those publishers and also for the buy side as well, who are looking to actually buy across multiple formats and multiple environments. They're now able to come to one centralized team to make all of that happen and to understand exactly where every bit of their objectives can fit into the ecosystem, essentially. And in all honesty, the timing has actually been quite good in a lot of ways because the market has been under a lot of pressure through the pandemic, and for us to create efficiencies for them through that time has been a good thing, you know, to have that stabilizing force and that level of efficiency and practical application to what they're looking to achieve has been really good. So it's a bit sort of in at the deep end, really, in terms of merger plus pandemic plus working from home plus everybody needing a lot of support, but we've been able to rise to the challenge, and it's been a really good, what are we looking at, about 6 months, just over 6 months now.
Amazing. And I suppose just the one final thing I'm thinking of as well is that, you know, to a certain extent, although we miss all of the traveling that we've just spoken about, we all know how distracting that can wind up being as well. You know, what you're actually traveling and for and going to achieve is always, you know, something that's, you know, that's sort of exciting and to be looked forward to. And there's usually a lot of good stuff that comes out of that. But it also takes you away from your day to day, takes you away from emails, takes you away from the routines that you maybe have set up with your team members and so forth. Have you felt any benefits to sort of being all locked in the one place and therefore no choice but to just kind of get on with all of these operations things that you've needed to achieve?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We were able to really get stuck into a lot of the training, a lot of the very practical stuff, and we really went for it, especially from an APAC perspective. We immersed ourselves in all of the training and full integration really early on. I think we were very conscious that during a time of so much uncertainty, it was really important to create control wherever we could. And that meant information sharing, planning, integration, training. And for us to embrace that early on allowed us to take a lot of control back and to do things more on our own terms and to be really, really proactive and to just make things happen quickly on our own terms without anything being compromised. Yeah, you're absolutely right, though. Less time in airports, less time in taxis, less time on flights. That has been a positive that I'm going to take from the situation.
Definitely. I'm going to add to that, less jet lag. Kieran and I were just talking yesterday about, I think we were sort of exchanging favourite meals in Singapore moments. I don't know how we got onto this conversation, but we were talking about how we wanted to enjoy a lot of those meals again, just without the jet lag, because whenever we're in Singapore, we're always like in bits because of the, you know, the sort of time difference from Europe to that part of the world is utterly horrific. And it's just really nice to not have that in your life. You think of what you're just so much more switched on. Anyway, I digress. Thank you very much for a really enjoyable conversation, Julia. It was great to catch up with you. Great to hear about what's happening at Made Night and really good to chat through a couple of issues of the day with you. So thank you for that.
Thank you both. It's lovely speaking to you.
And thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.
For more on using contextual technology in a video advertising environment, join our upcoming webcast where we're going to be speaking with Alexis Faulkner, Head of Fast UK at Mindshare, and Rich Radden, Co-Founder and Co-CEO of Zephyr. It's going to be broadcast live on November the 5th at 3:30pm GMT, and you can sign up by visiting exchangewire.com/Zephyr. That's Z-E-F-R. Thanks for listening.